Beanie's thing held us up. Second dinner. If we could roll the tape, we'll get started. My name is Rick Dunning. I live in Northfield, Minnesota, and I teach geography at St. Olaf College and geology at Normandale Community College in Minneapolis. I have been talking in several sessions this week about, well, what I like to call the topic, how creation works, with the hope that if we understand creation a little bit better, then perhaps we will treat it with at least a little bit more respect. And tonight I'd like to consider our general setting. In Holden Village, we are part of the Cascade Mountain Range, and I'd like to talk a little bit today about the Cascades, and particularly the Cascade Volcanoes. What I will do is, first of all, in a few minutes, talk about what volcanoes are and some of the differences from one volcano to another. Then we'll take a brief photographic tour of the Cascade Range, show you some of the major volcanoes. And then I'll talk briefly about the history of the mountain range. Now, one thing that's important to understand right from the start is that the Earth's surface is very dynamic and is always changing. And there are two main processes at work. One set of processes we call the mountain building processes, those that create mountains on the Earth's surface, the forces within the Earth that create these mountains, and then the erosion processes that wear them back down again. So that the landscape we see on the surface today is the result of the continuous interaction between those two sets of forces, the mountain building lifting up high places and the erosion wearing down those high places again. Now, volcanoes are a very obvious example of mountain building because it's easy to envision a volcanic cone being constructed by successive eruptions of lava. That is mountain building taking place. And then here we see a volcanic cone. This is Mount Shasta in Northern California. Here we see a volcanic cone that has been constructed and then partially eroded. Now, a volcano is simply molten rock material, which typically we call lava, molten rock material coming up from below the crust, making its way to the surface, and then erupting on the surface, and when it erupts, we refer to it as a volcano. Sometimes that molten lava doesn't quite make it to the surface. Sometimes it hardens underground without erupting onto the surface. Here, for example, in Colorado, in the Black Canyon of the Gunnison River, you see veins of white volcanic rock penetrating through the older, darker colored rock. Here is an example in these veins of volcanic lava that did not erupt on the surface. It hardened in cracks underground. Here's the same type of thing on the coast of Maine. You see, again, dark colored rocks with some light volcanic rocks that penetrate through them. Again, lava that did not erupt onto the surface. Sometimes these masses of lava that cool underground can form huge masses of volcanic rock. And much of the Cascade Mountains around us are penetrated with these huge masses of volcanic rock that didn't erupt, but simply cooled underground before it ever reached the surface. Now, when we talk about volcanic eruptions, I'll make one simple point here. The kind of volcano, the shape of the volcano, and the type of eruption that comes from the volcano both depend on the composition of the lava, the chemistry of the lava. Okay, the shape of the volcano and the kind of eruption depend on the chemistry or the physical characteristics of the lava. Now, some types of lava we refer to as fluid lavas because they flow very easily across the landscape, much like water. And when a fluid lava erupts, then that lava spreads for very long distances away from the vent that the lava comes out of. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself just slightly. Before we go on, here is a slide of Devil's Tower in Wyoming. Again, an example of volcanic rock that cooled underground. In this case, rock that filled up the central vent of an old volcano. The volcano itself has been eroded away, and all that's left behind are the harder rocks that formed in the vent of the volcano. Now we can go on to fluid lavas. This is Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii. These are a couple of borrowed slides. I haven't made it over there myself yet. But here, the volcano is very low and very wide in its shape. This is the kind of volcano that forms from the eruption of fluid lavas, because the lavas erupt and flow out easily in all directions. This is the crater at Mauna Loa, steaming at this point. Some of the lava in the crater there has got a hardened surface on it, but there still is hot lava right below the surface there. When a volcano erupts in Hawaii, people don't run away. They go up to the crater and watch it. Eruptions of fluid lava are not dangerous. They're not violent. They're not explosive. The only danger you have with fluid lavas is if your house is in the way of the lava flow. But the eruption itself is not a violent sort of volcanic eruption, because the lava flows so easily and because it doesn't have much gas trapped inside the lava. This is the surface of an old lava flow in New Mexico. This is the way that the lava hardens, at first on the surface, and then as the underlying lava keeps moving, you get this crinkly sort of appearance. This is known as pahoehoe lava from the Hawaiian classification. This is looking at that same lava flow from a side view. Here you see the lava flow in dark gray up near the surface, covering some old stream gravels. So the lava flow is, in this case, younger than the stream gravels that it buries. This is looking at a young lava flow in Idaho near the Snake River. You can easily pick out the lava, very dark in color. Typically, this fluid lava is black. We call it basalt as the kind of rock. But it is low in silica, and therefore it is very fluid. And you can see where the edge of the lava flow ended, but it flowed a very long distance to cover that much of the landscape. So fluid lavas flow very easily. Now we have some of those fluid lavas in parts of Washington and Oregon and parts of Idaho. Extensive areas are covered by lava flows to build up the Columbia River Plateau. And the area in gray on the map shows you where that Columbia Plateau is. If you came from the east across the central part of Washington, you may have driven through the Coulee Country and some of the area in central Washington and seen this type of landscape. In the sides of the canyons and the sides of the coulees, you can see the individual layers of lava very easily. Each of these layers represents an individual lava flow. As I say, the lava comes out of the vent and then flows easily across the landscape. And after one eruption right after the other, gradually builds up this high plateau surface that makes up much of central Washington.
There's one layer about three down that has really scalloped.
Yes. Oftentimes, when one layer was deposited, then it would be eroded by streams. And then another layer would come along and smooth out the landscape, and that would be eroded. And then another layer, gradually filling in the little valleys.
So these happen thousands of years apart, not just like
they could,
every couple of years.
In some cases, there may have been quite a long time between the flows. In other cases, they might have happened close together. Variable rates. Okay. Now, we talked about fluid lavas. The other kind of lava we'll mention is a sticky lava composition, or a viscous lava. And because it's sticky in composition, it tends to erupt very violently, because that sticky lava will plug up the vent of the volcano and the pressure will build up underneath it. And when the volcano finally erupts, the eruption is very explosive and very violent. And in generally in those kinds of eruptions, there's very little lava that comes out of the volcano. Usually it's in the form of ash and pumice and that kind of debris. Now when a sticky or viscous lava erupts, sometimes you'll get these little cinder cones right around the vent of the volcano, and you won't build up a large volcanic cone. Usually to get let me show you an example of a viscous lava erupting. Here's Mount St. Helens in the prime of one of its eruptions. And again, this is a classic example of a sticky, viscous lava erupting very violently, very explosively, and a dangerous kind of eruption because of the force of that explosion. Here's a seismograph to measure the earthquakes associated with one of these volcanic eruptions. So when the volcano erupts, it produces a great deal of earthquake activity. Now, this is another view of Mount Shasta, which we started with. When we think of volcanoes, we usually think of these nice cone-shaped mountains. These kinds of volcanoes are called composite volcanoes, and they are built up gradually through eruptions of lava and ash, and then more lava, and then some ash, so that the composition of the lava varies slightly from one eruption to another. Sometimes it may be sticky lava, sometimes it may be more fluid lava. Gradually, as these flows build up, then you get a classic cone-shaped volcano that some people refer to as a stratocone or a composite cone. Now, most of the Cascade volcanoes are of this kind of volcanic character, the composite volcano. Sometimes they erupt slightly more fluid lavas and build the cone up. Sometimes they erupt slightly more viscous lavas, explosive lavas, and those kinds of eruptions tend to destroy the cone. So some cone-building eruptions, some cone-destroying eruptions. Here's a map of the Cascade volcanoes. The Cascade mountain range runs from Northern California up into Southern British Columbia. It is a ridge, essentially, that runs the length of those states. But along the crest of this Cascade range, you have these volcanic mountains occasionally. So we start at the southern end with Mount Lassen and Mount Shasta in California, and then Mount McLaughlin, Crater Lake, Diamond Peak, Three Sisters are in here, approximately Mount Jefferson, Mount Hood, Mount Adams, Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier, Glacier Peak, which is the closest Cascade volcano to Holden. Holden would be about where the A is in Glacier there, and Mount Baker, and Mount Garibaldi, which would be off the top of the map here. So we've got a whole string of these volcanoes, these composite cones, running up the length of the Pacific Northwest. Now, here, the same picture we saw earlier of Shasta at the southern end of that range. We'll just take a quick trip up through, looking at a few of the volcanoes. Here is Crater Lake. Now, we don't really think of Crater Lake so much as a volcano. That's because the top of Crater Lake has essentially been destroyed in an eruption. Crater Lake at one time was a very large volcano known as Mount Mazama. And when Mount Mazama erupted, it erupted with such force that it essentially blew its insides out. And after the eruption, the cone of the volcano apparently collapsed, creating this large caldera, this basin, which filled up with water, and then there were some subsequent eruptions that created some small volcanic cones inside the lake. Yes?
Would that be roughly comparable in violence to Krakatoa or even to St. Helens? Or can you really compare it to St. Helens?
Much, much more than St. Helens ever would have been. Yes. Mm-hmm. And Krakatoa was the most violent eruption in recorded history since the 1800s. And even that would not have compared with probably the violence of Mount Mazama.
This is about 10 or 15,000 years ago?
This was about 6,000 years ago when Mount Mazama erupted. Now, this is a view from an airplane looking south from northern Oregon. This is Mount Jefferson and the Three Sisters. I'm sorry, that's a little bit fuzzy. The room's not quite dark enough for that. But if you're flying out of Portland, of course, the grandest site is Mount Hood. Here, clearly a perfect cone-shaped volcano, classic composite cone, very dramatic, very beautiful mountain. This is looking to the north from about the same position. This is Mount Hood again. Mount St. Helens before it erupted. Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. So that's looking up toward the north from northern Oregon. St. Helens, of course, after the eruption, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. In fact, let's talk about it now. When St. Helens erupted, the original eruption started as a big bulge in the side of the mountain, and then essentially this side of the volcano collapsed in a kind of landslide, and that allowed the volcano to erupt out toward the north. The eruption of Mount St. Helens was very carefully monitored and was predicted. The thing that surprised people a little bit was the fact that it erupted sideways more than straight up, and that caused quite a bit of damage as a result. This is looking at that north side of the volcano where it blew outward. Some of the damage that was associated with the force of that eruption, you see some trees toppled over here. Stepping back or getting back a little further, you can see the whole side of the mountain. The trees were just knocked over by the force of the blast in some very complex patterns. When volcanoes erupt, particularly these cascade volcanoes, often the most damage is associated with mud floats. Because remember that these volcanoes have a lot of snow and ice on them. The heat of the eruption melts that snow and ice. It mixes up with the ash and mud on the side of the volcano, and you can get some tremendous mud flows down the river valleys during the course of the eruptions. So here you see one of these mud flows, a vehicle trapped in the mud down below there. Just a general view of the devastation associated with that eruption. And a view of Spirit Lake, the former tourist hotspot, now kind of getting its rebirth in the tourist interest at looking at the volcano after the eruption. Now this is a satellite photograph, a weather satellite looking down at the Pacific Northwest. Here is the eruption of Mount St. Helens. This puff of ash that you see here is very early in the eruption. It can be seen and easily photographed from 700-800 miles up in space. So a very dramatic event. Back in the Midwest, we got some nice pink sunsets from that eruption. I remember those, but we didn't have near the problem dealing with ash that the folks here in the Northwest did. Continuing our little photo tour, here is Mount Adams. Mount Rainier, which is probably the crown jewel of the Cascade Range. And just another view of Rainier from the clouds. And of course, our closest volcano, Glacier Peak, which is just about 25 miles or so to the west of us here. Now, to understand the Cascade volcanoes, you need to understand the kind of general geologic process is taking place. This is a map of the region. And again, for those of you that weren't at my presentation yesterday about plate tectonics, the crust of the Earth is broken up into large pieces that we refer to as plates. And as these plates move around, they interact with each other on the boundaries of the plates. And it's those plate boundaries where most of the action is taking place in terms of mountain building and geologic activity. Well, here we have the North American plate and the Pacific plate, which makes up most of the floor of the Pacific Ocean. The Pacific plate, at this point in time, is gradually shifting to the north relative to the Americas plate. And we see the effects of that in the San Andreas Fault line down through California. There is, however, a little bitty piece of plate right here in the Pacific Northwest that is still colliding with the North American continent. This little bitty piece of plate is being shoved underneath the North American continent. I'll go to a diagram of that in just a second, but it's also important to realize that the Cascade volcanoes are part of what we call the Pacific Ring of Fire, and that the entire Pacific Ocean is nearly surrounded by volcanoes associated with these plate boundary collisions. This is what the plate boundary looks like in a simplified cross-section. This little bitty piece of plate that makes up the, that's sitting just off the coast of Washington and Oregon, is being forced underneath the North American continent. And as this plate dives down underneath the crust, the friction and the force of that plate collision generate molten rock. That rock rises to the surface as lava erupts onto the surface to create these Cascade volcanoes. So the Cascades result from a very active and continuing plate collision between the North American plate and this little piece of plate known as the Juan de Fuca plate, still being forced underneath the North American continent. So when we talk about mountain building as a set of processes, it is the plate collisions that cause mountain building. The force of these plate collisions, which crinkle up and deform the edge of the continent and also generate the lava that erupts onto the surface in the form of volcanoes. Now, we'll talk just briefly here about the geologic history of the Cascades. This, as soon as we talk about geologic history, I always feel like I have to talk about geologic time a little bit first, because that's always a hard thing for people to grasp. And I did this a little bit on my hike on Monday, but let me do it again briefly. By most estimates, or most of the currently accepted estimates, the Earth is over 4.5 billion years old. Now, whenever people start talking about billions and millions of years, my mind kind of goes numb because I can't imagine that kind of time expanse. So one way that I try and help people think about this geologic history is to imagine that we could take all of those 4.5 billion years of time and compress them into 1 year, just 12 months. So we pretend the Earth is 12 months old. Well, if we do that, then that helps us to realize how very young some of these mountain features are. Now, on that time scale, 1 month would be about 375 million years. So if we got 12 months, then the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. 1 day would be roughly 12 or 13 million years. So you need to adjust your thinking, like I say, adjust your thinking about time. With that kind of time scale, the last glaciers melted out of this valley about 10 minutes ago. the dinosaurs were tromping around on the Earth about 10 or 15 days ago. The U.S. Declaration of Independence was signed about 2 seconds ago in this year of geologic time. So our human perspective relative to the expanse of Earth history is fairly small. But maybe if we think about this in terms of 12 months instead of 4.5 billion years, it'll help us get a little better grasp on things. Now, this plate collision that I've been talking about with the previous diagram has been going on along the west coast of North America for about 20 days, the last 20 days of our geologic year, or about the last 200 million years. That began when the continents started to break apart. At one time, all the continents were together about 20 days ago. So they began to break apart, and North America moved west, which meant that the west side of North America was the leading edge of the continent, and therefore subjected to intense mountain building. So there has been mountain building taking place along the edge of the continent for about the last 200 to 100 million years, or about the last 10 or 20 days. These mountains are not that old. Remember that when mountains are created by mountain building, they get eroded again. So as soon as the mountains are created, then they're eroded away. And this last 10 or 20 days of geologic time has been a continuous process of mountain building and then erosion, mountain building and then erosion. In the Pacific Northwest, volcanic activity has intensified in about the last day of our geologic year. Finally, we start to get very heavy volcanic activity here in the Pacific Northwest. The Cascade volcanoes, or at least some volcanoes, began to form in the modern position in about the last 2 or 3 hours. Okay? Think about this for just a second. We just said the Earth is 12 months old, and we're finally getting these volcanoes starting to form about 3 hours ago. So compared to the age of the Earth, these mountains are very, very young, just within the last couple of hours of our geologic year. Now, Glacier Peak, which we're looking at here, the oldest lava flows on Glacier Peak are about 1.5 hours old, or about 700,000 years, about 1.5 hours in our geologic year. Glacier Peak is built on a ridge. I think you can see that. There's just the cone from here up, and then this ridge of rock. This ridge was being uplifted by mountain building as the volcano was forming. Most of the modern Cascade volcanoes were built essentially within the last half hour of our geologic year. Most of the modern Cascade volcanoes, the cones that we see today, most of those were built in the last half hour, or about the last couple 100,000 years. So these volcanoes are very, very young compared to the age of the Earth. Glacier Peak erupted about 12 minutes ago. That was the last major eruption of Glacier Peak. That was about 12,000 years ago. Now, while these volcanoes were being created, there were also glaciers in this same landscape, so that the mountains were being eroded by glacial activity and by stream action as they were being created. So as the volcano erupted, then it would be eroded away and then erupted again. That's why I say that the volcanoes have been in this position for about the last 2 hours, but the modern day volcanic cones are only about a half hour old, because the volcanoes would erupt and then be eroded away and then erupt again. This last eruption of Glacier Peak scattered ash and pumice over a very large area. perhaps covering most of the Pacific Northwest. Just to help you put this in perspective then, Crater Lake, which we looked at earlier, formed about 6 minutes ago with the eruption of Mount Mazama. And the modern cone of Mount St. Helens, the mountain that we see, or at least the mountain that was partially destroyed in Mount St. Helens, formed in the last 2 or 3 minutes of our year of geologic time. And then within the last half second or so, it was partially destroyed by this eruption. Now, Glacier Peak has gone the longest without an eruption. 12,000 years ago was the last time Glacier Peak erupted. All of the other Cascade volcanoes have erupted more recently, and most of the Cascade volcanoes have erupted within recorded hundreds. Mount Lassen in California, Mount Shasta, Mount Hood, of course, Mount St. Helens, Mount Adams, Mount Rainier, and Mount Baker have all had eruptions since the 1800s. Sometimes it was just steam and gas and heat coming out, but they all have been volcanically active during that time.
How about the one in Canada, was that one?
Garibaldi, I'm afraid I don't know the history on that, sorry. Now, only two have erupted since 1900. That's Mount Shasta, or Mount Lassen in California, erupted last about 1921, and of course Mount St. Helens, which erupted in the early 1980s. Essentially, if we look at the timing of things, there's been about one major eruption every century in the Cascades, at least one major eruption, sometimes more than that. So again, they are very, very young mountains, and they are still active. They're still being built and sometimes destroyed by their own eruptions because that plate collision is still actively taking place. Now, one of the advantages of these eruptions of ash is that we can use them in other kinds of geologic research. This white layer is a layer of volcanic ash from the Cascade Mountain Range, erupted about 100,000 years ago. I think it's 120,000 years old. This is in Kansas. This is in eastern Kansas, not far from Kansas City. So that the ash from some of these older Cascade volcanoes covered much of the central part of North America. So those were some very, very big eruptions. And here, this ash helps us to tell very old glacial deposits from younger glacial deposits, because the anything underneath the ash has to be older than the ashes. Mm.
Excuse me, Rick.
Yeah.
In a case like this, where it's half a continent away, how can you tell which volcano it came from, or even which direction it came from?
By a very careful analysis of the mineral content of the ash.
So they have like a fingerprint for each
volcano. Yeah. Each volcano has a characteristic lava with each eruption. And so there's a very detailed chronology of these volcanic eruptions, which has been worked out. The ash from Glacier Peak is useful in dating other geologic events. Some of the older Mount St. Helens ashes have been used for dating young geologic events. Here again is a view of Glacier Peak. This is from the top of Mount Furno right behind us here. Again, Glacier Peak is the volcano that's gone the longest without an eruption, but even Glacier Peak has a number of hot springs around the base of it that are still active, suggesting that there is hot rock still fairly close to the surface in this area. As we fly eastwards from the Cascades, we look back on our closing sunset. That concludes my formal presentation, but I'd be most happy to answer any questions you might have.
This may be a dumb question, but what does this have anything to do with the causing of the buttes in Washington and Oregon?
Where specifically are the buttes that you're referring to?
From Bend, Oregon, on up.
A lot of the... As I understand it, a lot of those regions, the landscape results from lava that has been eroded, so that the buttes are remnants of lava flows, and then the surrounding rock has been eroded away from either side, from all sides of it.
Some of those are cinder cones too, I think. They're really quite regular. It's like pyramids or something. They're not really buttes, maybe, but they are.
Okay, so they're called buttes, but they're really cinder cones. No, okay, so I was thinking of a different area. All right, thanks. Yeah, it's in Idaho, in the craters of the Moon National Monument, a number of the cinder cones are also referred to as buttes there. They're at least called buttes on the map.
St. Helens, that when that blew all that dust that we heard about that scattered all over the state, the soot and stuff, did that also have a hot lava flowing from that?
No.
None.
No, there's been a bulge of lava that's built up in the vent of the volcano. But again, that lava is very, very sticky, so it didn't flow at all. All the eruption was an explosion of ash and dust. Yeah.
I have two questions. The first one is how far the relation to the core of the earth does the lava come from? Secondly, may you explain the hot springs? The short ones, like with the some hot springs, where does the water come from? And I'm not sure.
The lava comes from just below the crust of the earth, not from deep inside. And the crust is only a thin shell around the whole earth. It's very, very thin compared to the total thickness of the earth. So in the continental areas, the crust may get up to 60 kilometers thick, but that's exceptionally thick crust. But compared to the total thickness of the earth, that's just a thin shell. So most of that lava is coming from just below the crust. And as far as the hot springs, the water is part of the groundwater system, where you would normally get well water from, water that's contained in the pore space of the rocks. But because in volcanic areas that groundwater is very close to hot rock, not far below the surface, the water is heated by the heat coming from the lava or the hot rock underground, and that's what leads to the hot springs primarily. Other questions?
Yeah. When volcanic ash is formed, it's in these real sticky lavas, what causes something that's as solid as, I'm sure it's much more viscous than molasses or anything I can think of offhand, what causes it to fly off into just a vaporized mess? Is it just strictly the gas pressure inside the lava that does that?
The gas pressure and then the force of the explosion that finally blows the lava out of the vent, essentially, because the lava will stick into the vent and then the pressure will build up and build up underneath it until finally the force of that eruption essentially pulverizes the lava. Could someone turn a couple lights on back in the corner there? Maybe that would gonna help us a little bit. I don't wanna... Yeah.
A few years ago, there were a lot of articles in the Northwest newspapers about Baker was doing things, steaming, and a lot of sort of scare about what could happen in Seattle and Everett. Do you know what's happening recently?
Only just what you said there, that that they're at least monitoring the activity there.
Do we expect there to be an increase in activity due to the plate, in the next century or so? Or?
I don't know on that. I think all we have to go on is the past history, the past frequency of the eruptions. At this point, I don't know that there's any reason to expect them to speed it, to intensify or to lessen particularly. Plate tectonics as a theory is so young that we don't have the kinds of measurements that would be necessary to make any sort of judgment like that. The theory of plate tectonics has only been widely accepted in the last two decades. So it's a very, very young understanding of how the earth works. Yeah.
How's the weather been affected by these huge eruptions? Like, has there been a change, or is that just
no? Very, very good question. There's several ways that volcanoes might affect weather. One is from the volume of ash and dust that gets into the atmosphere. When Krakatoa, for example, erupted in the late 1800s, the year after the eruption was known as the year without summer because of the ash kind of blocking out the sun's rays and causing a bit of cooling effect. That's a sort of short-term impact. More importantly, perhaps, may be the carbon dioxide gas that's emitted by volcanic eruptions. And during times of intensive volcanic activity, when several are going off relatively close together in time, there may be enough carbon dioxide entering the atmosphere to cause a warming effect, much like the greenhouse effect we worry about with our pollution. So that would be another possible effect.
Is this lava created from the original cooling of the Earth or from the movement of the plates?
Mostly it comes from the partial melting of that plate material as it moves down underneath the other plate. And so it's generated principally by the friction or the force of that plate collision. The other place where we have a lot of volcanic activity is where plates are spreading apart. And in those areas, hot rock is coming up from the mantle underneath the crust and solidifying to create new plate material. In that case, there may be actually a hot spot within the mantle that's causing the hot rock to rise up underneath the crust. And in that case, the source, the heat source for the molten rock may be much deeper. But even then, the lava doesn't become molten until it gets very close to the surface. The mantle rock is still solid.
Does anyone know when Glacier Peak is due to go off?
No. There are three ways or three classifications of volcanoes: active, dormant, and extinct. Extinct would be a volcano that is expected never to erupt again. Dormant is one that just hasn't erupted for a while. An active one is one that, like St. Helens, that is showing a lot of volcanic activity. At this point, Glacier Peak is the one that's closest to being classified as extinct, but even that one, it's still, particularly with the hot spring activity, people are still reluctant to say it's anything but just dormant at the moment. So it's possible, but it has gone the longest without an eruption. Question, yeah.
What is the temperature of the lava? Is it as it rises to the surface, or does that vary extensively, or is that a dirty collection?
I'm afraid I don't know. Okay. Sorry. It's measured in thousands of degrees. Other questions? Yeah.
As the plate moves further in length, what's happening with the size of the ocean? Is it also getting closer and closer?
Presumably, with the movement of the plates, the Pacific Ocean should be getting smaller, and the Atlantic Ocean, where the plates are spreading apart, should be getting bigger. Although, because of the complexity of the plate boundaries, we need to be a little careful about how we say that, but that, in very simple terms, that's what's happening. Yeah.
How much activity has there been on the San Andreas Fault as far as plate movement?
A lot of activity. Enough to measure how much the plates have moved relative to each other. In the case of the San Andreas Fault, the Pacific Plate to the west is moving slightly northward past the Americas Plate, so they're moving laterally past each other. And the San Andreas Fault is that boundary between the plates as the Pacific Plate gradually shifts northward. And so it is possible to measure how much displacement is taking place along the San Andreas Fault, even just within the last 150 years or so.
Yeah, how much is it? Like 2 inches, 4 inches?
No, it's measured in tens of feet of movement.
So how long will it be before LA's up to San Francisco?
Well, it'd be a while yet. so that people in San Francisco can breathe easily. Yeah. Other questions?
Yeah. Are the continents, if you say they are fixed, or is there a possibility of them splitting? Apparently, though we are talking about the West, there has been volcanoes in other parts.
Oh yes, yes, very much so.
Is there a possibility of having maybe some of the continents?
That certainly is a possibility, particularly in the area of perhaps East Africa. You'll sometimes hear about the rift valleys of East Africa, a line of valleys running down the eastern side and the great lakes, a number of lakes in Eastern Africa situated in that rift valley. That may be a place where we might see a continent beginning to split apart.
In various hikes that I've done over the summer, I've noticed there's a lot of times a vein of some white quartz or something, mm-hmm. from maybe 8 inches thick to several feet thick. Where does that come from?
Well, the older rocks of this region are old sedimentary rocks that are very heavily deformed and altered by the mountain building that's affected them. But those older sedimentary rocks have been injected many times by volcanic rock that hardened underground. And essentially those veins are just intrusions, thin intrusions of molten lava into the surrounding darker rock material. That volcanic history of even the Holden area, the volcanic activity is very, very, very complex because there have been a number of these intrusions of volcanic rock into the older rock material.
Are there many active volcanoes under the ocean?
Yes, yes.
How might they impact?
Well, the main areas of volcanic activity in the ocean are where plates spread apart. The spreading boundaries, because there hot lava is rising to the surface and hardening almost continually. The effects on the surrounding ocean and the atmosphere are very, very minor because they're primarily fluid lavas, so they're not violent eruptions, and they're localized in a fairly small area. The one area one example of an area where we find volcanoes away from a plate boundary would be the Hawaiian Islands, because the Hawaiian Islands are right almost in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in the middle of the plate. And the theory that explains the Hawaiian Islands is that the plate, the Pacific Ocean plate, is riding over the top of a hot spot in the mantle. And as the plate rides over the hot spot, then lava keeps erupting to the surface, and the volcanoes eventually get tall enough to form islands as they stick their heads out. So the youngest islands in the Hawaiian chain are those that are at the southeast end, and then the islands get progressively older as you go to the northwest, because that's the direction that the Pacific plate has been moving. So it's just hot lava poking up through the plate, essentially.
What's causing the hot spot?
That's a tougher question. The heat inside the Earth, the heat from the core of the Earth, has been slowly escaping outward. So that essentially you could think of the Earth as gradually cooling off very slowly. And as that heat makes its way out through the mantle, the main conduits of the heat will create hot spots under the crust. The position of those hot spots will change as the flow of heat inside the Earth changes. And that we're just barely beginning to understand how the interior of the Earth works. That's one of the great frontiers of geophysics right now, is understanding the heat flow patterns within the mantle.
Theoretically, is the Earth collapsing in on itself? Is that cool? Is it getting smaller? Because of cooling, or is the Earth getting larger because there's more rock coming to the outside? Or is it about the same?
My understanding is that the size of the Earth does not change dramatically in this process. What's happening inside the Earth is that much of the core
is liquid, molten rock. And as the Earth continues to cool, more and more of that molten rock solidifies to form an inner core of solid iron. So as the Earth cools, that inner core gets bigger and bigger, and the molten outer core has been getting smaller. I don't think the overall size of the Earth will change much.
Is this pattern, can we tell if it's evident at all in other planets around us in our solar system?
Well, both the Moon and Mars show extensive evidence of volcanic activity, but essentially no evidence of plate movement, certainly no modern plate movement. Both the Moon and Mars are essentially cold planets. They have completely lost their interior heat, so that the volcanic activity is all quite old on those planets. But no evidence that I know of plate motion on the surface of Mars, maybe because it's a smaller planet and cooled off very relatively quickly.
Yeah. So is the plate motion caused by the cooling of the Earth?
It's caused essentially by the heat escaping out through the Earth, which apparently sets up convection currents within the mantle rock. The rock below the crust is solid rock, but rock that can be deformed very slowly like a plastic because of the tremendous heat that it's under. So as the heat escapes out through the mantle, then the mantle rock slowly moves in convective currents, and apparently the plates sort of ride around on top of those convective currents. Well, thank you all. Wonderful questions, and thank you for your attention.